Money FM 89.3, best of weekends. International News Review.
On to our International News Review segment with Steve Okun, Senior Advisor at McLarty Associates. Steve, good morning. Great to have you on yet again here on Money FM.
Good morning, GVZ. Going old school, just the two of us.
Just the two of us. Yes, indeed. Well, you know what? I do enjoy having a co-host on Sundays, and you and I have had this discussion before. But every now and then, you know, you just got to, like you say, you got to kick it old school. So that's what we're doing today. So, but lots going on in the world. And I think the biggest one probably is Alibaba at the moment, this $3.7 billion fine that the central government in China has levied on them for anti-monopoly violations. There is so much more going on behind the scenes than we will ever know about this story, I'm sure. But from your perspective, what are you seeing as the big takeaways on this?
There's lots of takeaways. And I think one of the things to start with is, you know, how much power should tech companies have? You're having this debate in the United States. You have this debate in Europe. You're having this debate in China, and there are different types of debates, because what you see in Asia that you don't see in the West are these super apps, right? You see these super apps. So like in the US, if you want to order food, you go to one app. If you want to hail a ride, you go to a different app. And if you want to pay for something, you go to another app. Whereas in China, in Singapore, right across Asia, there's one app for everything. And these are these super apps. So these super apps have a tremendous amount of power, both over your personal data. They have a tremendous amount of power over the different companies that want to be on their platform. And China has found that Alibaba abused that monopoly power that they have as a super app. And so they fined them, you know, $3.7 billion. Now, there's a lot of other things at play, too, like politics. But clearly, the power of the super apps is something governments are going to have to take a look at.
Steve, we've seen this over and over again, and there's been talk about Google and talk about, obviously, Facebook and all of the properties it owns, Instagram and WhatsApp, et cetera, and as you mentioned. But this is a reality of the world we're living in. It's not like the 19th century where the train robber barons and the coal robber barons and all these guys were operating in the original antitrust suits, if you will. But like, this is just how our world is today. How do you say to an Alibaba, you've got to break up your company? You've been successful. You've done the right thing. You've got to break up your company. Like, the reality.
Well, that's the question. Did they do the right thing? Right. I mean, I think what's happened is that business got out in front of government, it got out in front of regulation. That happened everywhere. And what little regulation was in place was written before these companies got to where they are today. And so Government is now taking a step back saying, we need to look at this, right? Right. In the US, right? The government started with the position on liability, that the internet companies would have no liability for what their users put on their platform. That is going to get relooked at in the US. How these companies are going to operate, who they can buy, how much power they have over data, over who goes into their platform, what demands they will have to allow you into the platform, that is going to get looked at too. And so it isn't, you've been successful, we're just going to step back. This is now government coming in saying it's time to regulate before it gets more power concentrated in companies. And it's more of an issue in a country like China, where you have super apps, where these companies have even more power than they have elsewhere.
But just a month ago, this billions of dollars fine comes following 30 days ago when the Chinese government asked Alibaba to divest itself of its media holdings, right, including the South China Morning Post. So, are we seeing a trend here with the central government feeling that some of these companies are a bit of a threat, bit too powerful in various areas, in e-commerce, in media, et cetera. Let's put the hammer down.
Well, it's, if it's not put the hammer down, it's let's get some clear rules as to what's allowed and what isn't allowed. I mean, you look what happened in the United States. You have Facebook and you have Twitter banning the president of the United States from their platform. That, of course, would never happen in China. But at the same time, you know, China recognized that how much power are we going to give these successful billionaires? Are these billionaires going to have more power? And that comes at the cost of the power of the state and in China, of course, of the party. And so that's why you've seen Jack Ma literally once in about, 6 months or so, after he had great criticism over the regulatory authority that the Chinese government was trying to input over Alibaba. And they have lost, forget the $3.7 billion fine, billions and billions of dollars from their market cap. They weren't able to IPO some of their holdings. And so it is going to be a debate that's happening globally. It's in a different context in China, of course, than it is in other markets. But yeah, that's part of it.
Again, so much going on behind the scenes that most of us mere mortals will never understand behind the curtain, if you will, on the mainland. So, but a very interesting topic nonetheless to follow and see what else and see which other companies may find themselves in the crosshairs as well in China in coming days, coming months. Okay, let's talk about Joe Biden's $1.5 trillion budget for 2022, 16% domestic boost in domestic spending, 8% more than Trump's last budget, I believe. Take us through what the high points of this is.
Well, it's a budget starting position. It's a budget proposal because it really doesn't get deep into the weeds yet. This is the starting point. And, you know, to keep in mind, the executive branch in the U.S. has no authority to pass a budget. That is Congress. Congress has the power of the purse. So what this document does, and it is very important, is it sets forth what the administration's policies are going to be, what direction it wants to go. And then the Democrats, because they control the House and Senate, if they stay together, which is a different question, they can pass a budget without any Republican support. It'd be better with Republican support, but this is kind of the starting point. So you look at what's in this budget. It's got a 16% increase on the non-defense side, and it's got a 2% increase on the defense side. So the Democrats say you should be cutting defense spending. The Republicans say you should be having even more defense spending. So that's the kind of starting point you get. You see where they want to go. I think I read an analysis. The word race was mentioned, you know, racial justice, racial equality, spending to address racial disparities when it comes to education. I think it was mentioned like 22 times in this 55-page budget, wherein the last Trump budget, which was triple the size, had zero mentions of race. So you're going to see the direction the Democrats are going to go. And you also see, of course, that there's $0 allocated for Trump's wall. Right. So you see that coming out in the budget, too. But this is a starting point of for a lot of debate that's going to be happening.
Oh, I'm reading the numbers: $769 billion for non-defense programs, $753 billion for defense spending. The Democrats, over time, of course, have been known to be more friendly toward the social programs, schools and kids and those types of things. One of the big elements of this, though, is investing in infrastructure, is it not? Which is something that, you know, even Donald Trump has said during his time was necessary.
Well, there's two different bills. So there's a standalone infrastructure bill that is going to move. This is the budget bill. So this is how the government gets funded and then what money will be used within each of those different departments. Right. So the Department of Transportation gets an allocation, the Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Education. So you can see the priorities here. Right. In this budget, the Department of Education gets a 40% boost off of last year. Right. And that money is going to students in high poverty schools. It's going to support children with disabilities. It's going to funding for the historically black colleges and universities. So that's where this budget is. The infrastructure budget is a separate budget that's going to move through the Congress as well.
Okay. When would what will the process be? I know that this budgeting process has been tortured in recent years or decades even, and oftentimes it's not passed when it should be, and they have to do continuing resolutions and all this sort of stuff. But if all goes to plan, what would the process look like from here?
Well, again, part of this debate is, can the Democrats and Republicans work together? Will the Biden administration, you know, try and pass this budget through regular order? And to do that, you need 10 Senate votes from Republicans to get to 60, assuming all 50 Democrats stay together. Mm. That will take time to get the type of compromise that's needed. That would be best. But the Biden administration is saying we're going to have a bipartisan budget, but it's going to be bipartisan with support of Republicans, not necessarily the Republicans in the Congress. And so if you have a real budget process where you have hearings and you have the Republicans and Democrats working together, it could take to the end of the year.
Yeah.
If this goes through reconciliation where the Democrats say we can do a budget with just our 50 votes, it's going to be a smaller budget, but it can get through. Hopefully, we can get this done as a country in the regular order because it would be better. But right now, the Republicans are talking a lot about social issues and less about budgetary issues. So it's just a starting point. No predictions yet.
Yeah, it comes at an important time, though, right? With coming out of COVID and wanting to have the full faith in the government of the U.S. and for business that is trying to see a more, I guess, calm in the governmental structure of the U.S. to try to get back on track. I mean, there are some things here at play that are quite important to have a budget, any budget, passed in relatively short order without too much rancor.
Well, I mean, we haven't been able to do it as a country, as you mentioned, in
years,
like a decade or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is one of those things where, you know, elections matter. Who the president is matters, because the president, while he doesn't have the authority to, you know, to write the budget and fund the country, he can veto if he doesn't like the budget that gets passed by the Congress. So it's important for all sides to work together. This is a budget that is full of you know, the Democratic priorities that Joe Biden ran on. It addresses, you know, the racial injustice and racial disparity issues. It addresses the environmental issues by putting in, you know, $14 billion more on climate change related spending. And so will the Republicans agree that this is the type of budget that is needed? Is it the type of budget that can get enough support from both sides, or is it going to be, you know, just we're, you know, Republicans block Democrats, Democrats block Republicans, and we stay in the mired in the same dysfunction that we've had for quite some time now?
Let's hope not. I'm getting tired.
Let's hope not.
I'm getting tired of these stories, quite honestly. I'm sure a lot of people are. All right, let's move on to our good friends in the Philippines. Rodrigo Duterte, been AWOL for, not AOL, Time Warner, been AWOL for, yes. You can tell who I used to work for, has been AWOL for 2 weeks now, no public appearances. Aides say he's just fine, but the rumor mill has been exploding, everything from he's had a stroke to then he flew to Singapore for medical treatment to he's dead to he's got COVID. 100 of his bodyguards apparently have COVID as of recently. So what do we know? I mean, we don't want to get too far into the weeds in terms of speculation and conspiracy theories and all that. But there was a story in the Straits Times about this today. What do we know so far, and what should we not be talking about?
Well, I mean, I think that what we know is it is tough to be president of the Philippines. Right? I mean,
yes, in any age,
but it's really tough now. You've got COVID. The pandemic is you know going they're having another wave in the Philippines. You know, increasing cases, increasing deaths. As you mentioned, you have the presidential bodyguards. They said there were maybe about 100 COVID cases within there. And so you've got, you know, and then the economy, which, you know, I think went down 9.6% last year. So you've got COVID and all the economic crisis. At the same time, you've got China really flexing its muscles in the South China Sea. They just put hundreds, maybe a couple hundred Chinese fishing vessels,
right,
off one of the reefs that are in Philippine, the maritime area. And the Philippines said, you know, China's trying to intimidate us with all of these all these vessels there. And China said, oh, no, they're just taking shelter from the wind. Right? This is so really, really tough time. And so, you know, one of the critics of a former senator in the Philippines said, you know, Duterte is not dead. He's not sick. He's just lazy.
That's what he said. Yeah, I was one of his strong critics at that. But I was surprised to read in the Straits Times article just how many ailments he has: back problems, migraines, this Barrett's esophagus, which affects his throat. He suffers from Berger's disease, which causes blockages in blood vessels. He's admitted to having autoimmune disease that causes muscle weakness. I mean, and he's joked about having cancer a number of times. I mean, this is a guy that's got some issues.
Well, he does, and that's certainly, you know, whether he's been vaccinated or not, presumably he has. Mm. But still, you know, if you have those underlying health concerns, you don't want to be in an area where COVID is rampant right sure. now, especially if you can't be protected. So, I mean, it kind of makes sense that he would be, you know, lying low. Maybe he has it and he's isolating, and you can do that in the Philippines. You can, I mean, obviously. You know, Donald Trump tried to do that in the White House, but then when he had to go to Walter Reed, you know, the U.S. media could find that. Maybe he has it. So it could very well be health related. It could very well be that he's just under tremendous pressure, because remember, he tried to take the Philippines less towards a U.S. centric foreign policy, towards a Chinese foreign policy. Yep. He's now relying on China for the vaccines, and China at the same time is flexing its muscles when it comes to the South China Sea and the Philippines again. So, you know, the president's had nothing to show for his shift towards China. It's just a really tough time to be the president of the Philippines.
He famously told the U.S. to take a hike when he first arrived in office in the U.S. Navy, right, which had been, kind of a protector of the Philippines' navigational lanes for 100 years or more. But I think he's now reaping some of what he sowed back in those days. Okay, let's move on. Our last topic today, the Republic of Singapore and the U.S. celebrating 55 years of official diplomatic relations. What a relationship this is, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, and especially you look at the economic relationship between the two countries. I mean, Singapore is the U.S.'s 14th largest export market, which is pretty remarkable given the size of Singapore. The U.S. has almost $300 billion in direct investment here, and it was a huge jump from 2018 to 2019, which are, I think, the latest figures that are available. So you have such a strong economic relationship. You have, you know, a strengthening relation. Well, it's always been a strong relationship bilaterally between the U.S. and Singapore, but now with the Biden approach towards multilateralism and towards ASEAN, it's going to take on increasing relevance. And then, of course, at the same time, you have a strong relationship between China and Singapore. So there's never been, more critically important for the U.S. to look at Singapore from an economic and diplomatic perspective. It's always been a strong reason to do so, and it continues to strengthen every year.
Yeah, the relationship goes back over 175 years, right, when Joseph Balestier was the first consul that was put in place here in Singapore in the 1800s. So the relationship is longer than 55 years, to be sure, but these past 55 years since Singapore's independence have been a key era in development of, as you say, the business, the security relationship, and that continues to go on. I had Chargé d'Affaires Rafik Mansour on last Sunday talking about that, and that podcast is available on our Money FM podcast site as they celebrate not just this week, but an entire year starting now of the bilateral relationship with events going on. So there's lots to see and do. All right, Steve, thanks for your time today. Lots going on in the world. I'm sure there'll be much more next week. Maybe we'll see where Duterte ends up. Who knows? We'll look for him during the course.
We'll see if we can find him. I'll keep my eye out in Singapore if I can see him on Orchard Road.
There we go. Thanks so much to Steve Okun for our international news review. Great to see you. Have a good day.
You too.
International News Review.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.